Welcome to the Future of Pharma with ISB Boston, where I talk to the thought leaders of the pharmaceutical industry about where our industry is headed and what you can do about it. I'm your host, Samir Gondalia. Thanks for joining us today.
My guest today is Mark Sikorski. Mark is the founder and CEO of High Purity New England, HPNE, based in Northern Rhode Island, just 45 minutes south of Boston. HPNE is a rapidly growing company. It's been around for over a couple of decades. And in last few years alone, the company has grown from a small team of less than 10 employees to about 350 in 2022. If you are working for a biotech or a biopharma company in New England, the chances are your lab or your facility, your manufacturing facility, you are using something that was procured through HPNE. Mark and his team of committed professionals at HPNE, they supply the biotech and biopharma companies with a variety of innovative single-use solutions. They sell the biotech and biopharma market in 7 countries. And currently, HPNE is one of many companies supporting the global efforts of several companies working on vaccines and therapeutics in the fight against COVID-19. I have known Mark for almost 10 years now, and I had a lot of fun recording this interview with him. I got to ask him questions. Usually, I don't get to ask him when I see him. So I had a lot of fun and hope you enjoy this interview too. Here's Mark Sikorski.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing? Thanks for joining the Future of Pharma.
I'm good, Samir. Nice to see you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for joining. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Mark. So I thought that in this interview, we can begin at the beginning. So when you founded High Purity New England in 2002. Before that, what motivated you to start the company? What was the scenario like, and what made you want to start this company?
I was at the time working as a consultant, trying to help another company get a distribution contract for products. And the company that we were speaking to asked me if I would take over New England for them. And not necessarily work with the company that I was consulting for. So they came to me and said, we really would like to have you working for us in New England. And so they canceled the distributor that was here and appointed us a distributor. And that's why we started the company.
And what was the scenario like? So when you started, was it just as easy as someone asked you, or what were the challenges? I'm sure there were professional, family, you know, all those challenges. What were the challenges did you face during your earlier years?
I didn't know anything about pharma.
Oh, that helped. That helped. Well,
I shouldn't say that. I should say when I first started, I didn't really know much about it. But one of the reasons why I was working as a consultant at the time was that I was helping a company that made water systems. So I guess I did really know something about high purity water in pharma. And it came to be that having a lot of time in industrial instrumentation over the years, I was also consulting for a company that made data loggers for autoclaves. And I did a lot of traveling for them and a lot of setup of customers. And lo and behold, there was an article that got published that I wrote comparing the regulations in Europe and the US between EN 554 and the ISO standards. And it went viral, as we say today. It was printed in several languages. It made it even into a Chinese newspaper. So, and that's really how I guess I got my start. But one of the things I didn't really know anything about was the pharmaceutical process. So that was a big learning curve for me. And at the time, it wasn't just pharma. Part of the distribution agreement was also to cover semiconductors. And there was very little that I knew about photosensitive materials for that matter.
And you obviously, if you weren't familiar with the pharmaceutical sector, you probably had to build your network from scratch too, right? Because you probably didn't know too many people in pharmaceutical industry whose doors you can just knock and start selling.
Yes, I didn't. And the Boston ISP chapter was a godsend to me. I started going to the product show many years ago. I even have a picture of when we were still out at the Marriott where all the booths were packed up except mine, and I was still talking to customers. It was great.
it's very hard to see the progress you have made unless you have a snapshot of the past. So you started the company. What was the biotech scenario, biotech landscape in New England back then, about a couple of decades ago, in terms of number of companies, growth, new technology?
We track that quite a bit because of the numbers of companies that we actually work with. But one would guess that today there's 480 plus biotech companies in the New England market. And back then there was probably about 150. I would guess that the square footage in Cambridge has grown by maybe 2 million square feet since then too. Having not been there during COVID, I'm very eager to see what has been completed because we just don't go out to visit customers much anymore.
Right. Well, if you see LinkedIn feed, you can see they're building things in Cambridge, left, right, and middle. It's like any building that anybody's selling, some biotech company is buying it and they're building new things, which is good. For the society, in what it means is that there are scientists and entrepreneurs who are working on something that will cure something that will help the patients, not now, 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But Cambridge is growing crazy. It's, as far as Cambridge, it's kind of like post, like pre-COVID, as in it has become enormously difficult to get in and out of Cambridge. You know, the same traffic and all that stuff. I shouldn't make fun of it, but you can pretty much know you are in Cambridge based on the traffic you face on 90. But Cambridge is growing, you know. So when you were building, so that was the beginning. And while your company was growing, what were your biggest ups and downs, your biggest victories, however you define success,
The business has changed, that it's better for us now. In the old days, so to speak, we would work in process development. We'd help get a process developed, and then it would go to Puerto Rico. It would go to Belgium. It would go to Ireland, and the revenue that would be generated from the products that are sold when the drug goes commercial is far different than if you're toiling away in process development with little bits and pieces. Yeah. So, and that's changed now because titers have gone up. The technology's changed. mRNA. You can make drug products in Cambridge now. You don't have to go to Puerto Rico. You don't have to go to other places. So even though we're called Hyperion New England, we actually sell to 7 different countries and we distribute products all across the United States.
Well, which are the 7 countries? I didn't know. I mean, you and I talk when we meet. I thought you were New England centric.
So we have a lot of good business in the UK, okay. and some in Ireland right now. We supply Portugal, Spain, Germany, and Australia, and actually Taiwan.
That would be interesting. Usually everything gets imported from Taiwan. It would be
we've made some products of our own to keep ourselves separated a little bit in the marketplace. We have our own mixers. We have our own cross-flow TFF systems that we're going to launch in January. So we've made some of our own products in order to be able to be a little bit more independent from the people that we distribute product for. And those products can be sold all over the world.
I was actually saving this question for later on, but I think this is a good time to ask since we're talking about international markets. We hear a lot about supply chain disruptions due to COVID, right, in media. And, you know, from manufacturing to shipping to drivers who deliver at the end point, there is severe disruption and supply chain has suffered. Now your business, a big part of your business is just supply chain, you know, moving things from here to here, getting to the right people and so on and so forth. So what's the reality on ground in your business? How has the supply chain disruption affected you? How are you dealing with it? How much is truth? How much is, you know,
I think all of it's true. Okay. One of the problems with the single-use assemblies that we make is that there's no real dedicated resin that's used to make pharmaceutical plastic. All the people that are injection molding or extruding tubing are using food-grade resin. Mm-hmm. And that's the first problem. So if there's a demand for food-grade resin and pharmaceutical, who do you think the resin supplier is going to pay attention to? food's far greater than pharmaceutical. The things that we see, like this morning, they said that there's 45 more container ships that just entered the Los Angeles Bay. So that brings 145 container ships that are waiting to be unloaded. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's products in those container ships that we need. It's not just holiday gifts.
Right.
And so the demand of logistics is also has something to do with the people that are not gone back to work driving trucks or haven't gone back to working in warehouses. And to mitigate some of those things, we've been buying almost anything we can get our hands on. So we've bought for our pumps where the stainless steel fabricator needs steel, we actually go into the market and try to buy steel and supply it to them.
So you buy the raw materials and you give it to the manufacturer to make your parts.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
we're actually better. Buying steel right now and shipping it to China because they can't get steel.
Right.
Yeah. So and then in addition to that, a lot of the plastic parts and pieces we speculated. We've bought inventory not knowing whether we were going to use it or not. And so that's the way we've been able to mitigate it a little bit, but there's still a huge demand and bottlenecks when it comes to things like sensors. I mean, you just can't get them. 18 months delay.
Right.
Long time.
So what's the plan? Do the companies will have to wait for the sensor or make do without them? Or what do you see? Or will there be alternate, you know?
It really depends on what we can do. We're very proactive in the fact that we've found parts at distributors that don't necessarily need them and bought them from them. We have a very active materials department that's constantly searching for ways around things.
Mm.
The sensors is probably the one thing that we really can't get around unless we decide to make one ourselves.
What I found interesting was I was reading an article and they mentioned that about 50% of all the international cargo used to move via commercial airlines, passenger airlines. And I didn't know that. So, you know, all these passengers flying from London to JFK, well, they bring a lot of cargo with them, the commercial cargo. And because those flights are there, they're running, international flights are running at about 50% capacity or less actually in certain parts of the world. Like there is nothing flying in and out of Australia, for example. So that has impacted a lot. And this is where probably, you know, small delicate things like sensor, they get clipped, you know, because now they have to be choosy, like who can pay more money to ship their stuff and who can bear the brunt of shipping. Anyway, so that's one of the thing I was very surprised to find out that, oh, wow, you know, not only passengers, but 50% of the whole international cargo used to travel through passenger planes.
I didn't know that it was that high because we all think about container ships, but I do know that we wait 2, 3, 4 weeks to get a spot on an airplane for a container.
Mm.
It takes time. We import a lot of things from Europe, from Germany and from the UK, and we're always waiting to get a slot on an airplane to get things flown over here.
Right.
Always.
Right. Yeah. Every time. Yeah. So, and this is after COVID, obviously, right? Not before. This wasn't a problem before.
No, not before COVID. Before COVID, it was usually a couple day wait to make sure you got a spot, but now it's up to 3-4 weeks.
Right. And that's the reason, as I mentioned, because, you know, it's like very little capacity. So,
And that is the problem. There is very little capacity.
Right. And they use the, rightfully so, for critical items like medicines, and of course, those things they have to go. So those things get priority. Anything that has to do with life or medicine or therapy or, you know, all those things. Hopefully, let's hope it's not where we thought we would be today. You know, last year thought, at least, you know, I thought that, you know, fall 2021, we should get back to, you know, quite a lot of normalcy. We are not there yet. But compared to last year, it's much better. So I'm optimistic, you know, in few quarters, we'll eventually get there where we can get some more normalcy. What about the downs. It can't always be up, right? You're during your this business journey in the last 20 years, were there moments like very dark moments, you know, business failure, and you know, you're like, wow, that was, I'm so glad to have gone through this.
I suppose if I really have to talk about them, without naming the names of the suppliers, we've had several suppliers over the years that have decided they don't need us and they start to sell direct. And they certainly then make the margin that we were making. And when those decisions are made, they can be catastrophic. If it was 80% of your business of a product you're distributing, it's very hard to come back from those things. And that's happened to me twice. And it was a lot of money, and it was very difficult to overcome, not just from the financial perspective. I think you always are searching to decide, what did you do wrong? Why are they doing this to me? And you can't take it that way. You have to look at it as that it's a business decision on their part, not necessarily that they don't like me anymore.
Right.
So those were difficult things to overcome, but I do believe it was part of the drive to have some of our own products and our own things that we do. I mean, we have six class 7 clean rooms now. And the first one was the tiny little one that we almost built by ourselves in event. So we have this independence of our own products that we can sell that gives us some sense of security over the distributed products that we sell. But we continue to expand our distributed products. We have a couple new ones coming online this coming year in 2022.
So how did you manage those disappointments when you found out, you know, that all right, so-and-so company is going to do direct distribution? That means, you know, it's going to have impact on your revenue, your profit, you have people on your payroll. How did you approach it? How did you, you know, what did you do for next few weeks, few months to overcome that?
So we found some other things that we could sell, actually. But at the same time, we really just went out and worked harder. I mean, both times that we lost the product line, we recovered in the same calendar year, which is not easy to do when you lose 40% of your business and you can retain it. And actually, in both years, we still grew by a small single-digit growth rate. So,
okay. All right. So those things were not ideal, but they did teach you. Now, that brings me to sort of the present moment. In the last 2 to 3 years, High Purity New England has grown enormously. Every time I talk to you, every time we see each other, you have hired 50 more people and you are building a new facility. Tell us about the growth in particularly last 2 to 3 years, what's driving it, and if you can extrapolate it to what's going on in New England biotech landscape.
So I don't want to say that I had the foresight, but I must have, to think about working in the process development arena. And many companies do that. It's not just us, but we've been working at it for quite a few years. And now many of the things that we worked on are actually being made here and not necessarily in Puerto Rico, Belgium, Ireland, whatever. And we have drugs that are going commercial. We have, I guess, 7 new drugs by our customers that are getting launched in 2022. They were supplying all of the things for it. So that's caused a good deal of the growth. And I think that we're going to institute some new methods for acquiring work in 2022 and 2023 that'll just continue the growth. And the growth is rather astounding. 2020 to 2021 is 480% growth.
Wow, that's...
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's amazing.
So October of 2020, we were 50 employees and now we're 200. And we're going to try to hire 150 people between now and January for the new building that I showed.
Yeah, you still have lots of openings on your website. I just checked it today. You still have a lot of openings. You still are
really struggling. There's been some suggestion from my accountant, I guess. Do you think you've saturated the market for employees? Is the labor pool shrunk to where you're not going to be able to get those people? And I don't know the answer to that just yet, because there are ways to do that, no matter how tight the labor market is. And it's not just money that you can do. We are also struggling to find managers, quality manager, production manager. We're really struggling to find those types of people. It's amazing to me that there's such a shortage. In fact, for the first time in a long time, we're probably going to hire a dedicated recruiter people to come to work for us.
That actually brings me to my next question, which was reaching out to customer, advertisement, marketing, you know, that has changed. So now there's social media, there's LinkedIn, which is social media for professionals. How is HP&E using an ICU? You're on LinkedIn, you're active, you engage with people, you encourage people. So I know you are on LinkedIn. How does HP&E engage with your customers and potential, you know, employees? How do you share the message? And
most of it's done through social media of some kind, but we also do customer surveys. And not every employee here has the company email address, so we also communicate to them with company-wide memos that are posted on our bulletin boards and so forth and so on. But I think that we're providing an effective message almost every day on LinkedIn.
Right, right.
LinkedIn's become a constant platform for us. We just actually, a few months ago, launched a brand new website. It's completely different than it was before. And its look and its feel, but it's in its technical capability. It was built basically from the ground up to be Google sensitive.
Okay. So you can search and rank.
Yeah.
So about now a little something about you, Mark, you know, personally, who have been your heroes, you know, your leadership that you look at historical or, you know, can be current business leaders or military leaders? Who do you admire for the leadership style?
Well, I've been known to quote Henry Ford many times, and he used to say that I don't care if they're talking good, I don't care if they're talking bad, as long as they're talking about me.
Yes.
And I've often quoted Bill Gates, but he used to have a saying that said, if it takes more than 40 hours for you to do the job, you're probably the wrong person for the job.
Yeah.
Another ism. Other than those types of examples, I look to some of the people that we work with that are consultants that we work with that have had successful businesses in the past. And that's probably the main driver to what I look for in information from other people.
That's the saying, right? If you want to be smart, surround yourself with people who are smarter than you. And
I agree.
Yeah. So if you are always the smartest person in the room, then it's time to change the room. You need to go find people.
I completely agree.
I can teach you.
You know, and the growth of the company is really is starting to cause some more dramatic changes. I never thought I'd have a laboratory. In the new building, we're building a big laboratory to do all kinds of things. I never thought I'd have a chief scientific officer. I have one now. It's amazing.
You're thinking about hiring a recruiter. You talked about hiring new people. What advice would you give to young professionals who are joining the workforce or who are just starting out as, you know, like career advice? What you have learned from your career, okay, do this or don't do this?
Well, first of all, anybody that's graduating university right now, in my opinion, will have three careers. They'll move in from one industry to another. They may go back to school and get a different degree. My advice is always to be patient, to really be patient. Take the long-term view of something. And just because you didn't get $1 million in the first year you worked out of school doesn't mean you're not going to get $1 million.
Right.
So to be patient and pay your dues. I've had experiences in my life where I thought I could just go in and just change things. And I think that's the way a lot of people that are new to industry think they can do it. But you need to understand the landscape and what may have been tried before that may not have worked that you ought to know about before you try to change things.
Patience is such a useful, great advice and so difficult. Like everybody is on social media. So, you know, everybody wants whatever everybody has on social media. So not only young kids, but everybody can use a little bit of patience. Which books have you recommended the most to others? The books you ask others to, okay, well, you should read this or give.
I'm Okay, so you really caught me on that one because first of all, I'm not much of a book reader, but I do have some favorites. I like the mysteries that are written by Caleb Carr, but I have a very good friend in France, and I just had a long conversation with him, and I'm going to send him three books when the second or the third one comes in, and one's called The Zen of Listening, and the other one's called Coach. And so he's going through a career change right now. And I believe that he's going to go down the road of really being a good consultant in the fact that he's going to teach the right kind of companies how to sell their products. And and he was rather down in the dumps when I talked to him the other day, but I think he's in good, I think he's in good spirits now.
Mark, that brings us to towards end of our interview. I know you are active on LinkedIn. That is one place to find you. If one of our listeners get interested and wants to get in touch with you for something, how would you recommend someone get in touch with you?
Either LinkedIn or put in a request to the website. Okay. You know, my profile's on ISP's website. You know, has all my contact information, phone, email, and everything. So I've been a member of ISP for almost 20 years, probably 20 years, I suppose, more than that, maybe 24 years. So that would be one way to reach me, or just call the office and ask for me.
And
I do answer the phone.
You're not very difficult to find. I ping you on LinkedIn and you respond on the same day, more or less. Mark, thank you again. Thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed it.
Great to see you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to subscribe and let others know. Word of mouth is our oxygen. Visit www.ispeboston.org for the comprehensive show notes from today's episode and also find out more ways to associate with us. Do let us know your thoughts in the comment section. And if there is someone you'd like to see as a guest on the show, thanks again for joining us today. We'll see you next time. Thank you.